The dystopianist, thinking of his rival, is interrupted by a knock on the door. Read for you by John Linnell. The dystopianist destroyed the world again that morning, before making any phone calls or checking his mail, before even breakfast. He destroyed it by cabbages. The dystopianist's scribbling fingers pushed notes onto the page. A protagonist, someone, a tousle-haired, well-intentioned geneticist, had designed a new kind of cabbage for use as a safety device, the airbag cabbage. The airbag cabbage mimicked those decorative cabbages planted by the sides of roads to spell names of towns, or arranged by color, red, white, and that eerie, iridescent cabbage indigo to create American flags. It looked like any other cabbage, but underground was a network of gas bag roots, vast inflatable roots, filled with pressurized air. So, at the slightest tap, no, more than a tap, or vandals would set them off for fun, right. Given a serious blow, such as only a car traveling at 30 miles or more per hour could deliver, the heads of the airbag cabbages would instantly inflate, drawing air from the root system to cushion the impact of the crash, saving lives, preventing costly property loss. Only, the dystopianist pushed away from his desk and squinted through the blinds at the sun-splashed street below. School buses lined his block every morning, like vast, tipped orange juice cartons spilling out the human vitamin of youthful lunacy, that chaos of jeering voices and dancing, tangled shadows in the long morning light. The dystopianist was hungry for breakfast. He didn't know yet how the misguided safety cabbages fucked up the world. He couldn't say what grievous chain of circumstances led from the innocuous genetic novelty to another crushing totalitarian regime. He didn't know what light the cabbages shed on the death urge in human societies. He'd work it out, though. That was his job. First Monday of each month, the dystopianist came up with his idea, the green poison fog, or dehumanizing fractal download, or alienating architectural fad, which would open the way to another ruined or oppressed reality. Tuesday, he began making his extrapolations, and he had the rest of the month to get it right. Today was Monday, so the cabbages were enough. The dystopianist moved into the kitchen, poured a second cup of coffee, and pushed slices of bread into the toaster. The Times Metro section headline spoke of the capture of a celebrated villain, an addict and killer who'd crushed a pedestrian's skull with a cobblestone. The dystopianist read his paper while scraping his toast with shreds of ginger marmalade, knife-rushing a little surf of butter ahead of the crystalline goo. He read intently to the end of the account, taking pleasure in the story. The dystopianist hated bullies. He tried to picture himself standing behind darkened glass, fingering perps in a lineup. Couldn't. He tried to picture himself standing in the glare, head flinched in arrogant dejection, waiting to be fingered, but this was even more impossible. He stared at the photo of the apprehended man, and unexpectedly, the dystopianist found himself thinking vengefully, hatefully, of his rival. Once the dystopianist had had the entire dystopian field to himself, there was just him and the utopianists. The dystopianist loved reading the utopianists' stories, their dim, hopeful scenarios, which were published in magazines like Expectant and Encouraging. The dystopianist routinely purchased them, newly minted from the newsstands, and perverted them the very next day in his own work, plundering the utopianists' motifs for dark inspiration. Even the garishly sunny illustrated covers of the magazines were fuel. The dystopianist stripped them from the magazine's spines and pinned them up over his desk, then raised his pen like death's sickle and plunged those dreamily ineffectual worlds into ruin. The utopianists were older men who'd come into the field from the sciences or from academia, professor this or that, like Dutch burgers from a cigar box. The dystopianist had appeared in print like a rat among them, a burrowing animal laying turds on their never-to-be-realized blueprints. He liked his role. Every once in a blue moon, the dystopianist agreed to appear in public alongside the utopianists on a panel at a university or a conference. They loved to gather, the fools, in fluorescent lit halls behind tables decorated with sweating pitchers of ice water. They were always eager to praise him in public by calling him one of their own. The dystopianist ignored them, refusing even the water from their pitchers. He played directly to the audience members who'd come to see him, who shared his low opinion of the utopianists. The dystopianist could always spot his readers by their black trench coats, their acne, their greasily teased hair, their earphones resting around their collars, trailing to Walkmans secreted in coat pockets. The dystopianist's rival was a utopianist, but he wasn't like the others. The dystopianist had known his rival, the man he privately called the Dire One, since they were children, like those streaming into the schoolyard below. "Eeny, meeny, miny, mo!" they'd chanted together, each trembling in fear of being permanently it, of never casting off their permanent case of cooties. They weren't quite friends, but the dystopianist and the Dire One had been bullied together by the older boys, quarantined in their shared nerdishness, forced to pool their resentments. In glum resignation, they'd swapped wacky packages stickers and algebra homework answers, offered sticks of juicy fruit and squares of now and later, forging a loser's deal of consolation. Then they were separated, after junior high school, and the dystopianist forgot his uneasy schoolmate. It was nearly a year now since the Dire Utopianist had first arrived in print. The dystopianist had trundled home with the latest issue of Heartening, expecting the usual laughs, and been blindsided instead by the Dire Utopianist's first story. The dystopianist didn't recognize his rival by name, but he knew him for a rival instantly. The Dire Utopianist's trick was to write in a style which was nominally utopian. His fantasies were nearly as credible as everyday experience, but bathed in a radiance of glory. They glowed with wishfulness. The other utopianist's stories were crude candy floss by comparison. The Dire Utopianist's stories weren't blunt or ideological. He'd invented an aesthetics of utopia. Fair enough. If he'd stopped at this burnished, closely observed dream of human life, the Dire Utopianist would be no threat. Sure, heck, let there be one genius among the utopianists. All the better. It raised the bar. The dystopianist took the Dire One's mimetic brilliance as a spur of inspiration. Look closer. Make it real. But the Dire Utopianist didn't play fair. He didn't stop at utopianism, no. He poached on the dystopianist's turf. He encroached. By limning a world so subtly transformed, so barely nudged into the ideal, the Dire One's fictions cast a shadow back onto the everyday. They induced a despair of inadequacy in the real. Turning the last page of one of the Dire Utopianist's stories, the reader felt a mortal pang at slipping back into his own daily life, which had been proved morbid, crushed, unfair. This was the Dire One's pitiless art. His utopias wrote reality itself into the most persuasive dystopia imaginable. At the dystopianist's weak moments, he knew his stories were by comparison contrived and crotchety, their darkness forced. It was 6 weeks ago that Vivifying had published the Dire One's photograph, and the dystopianist had recognized his childhood acquaintance. The Dire Utopianist never appeared in public. There was no clamor for him to appear. In fact, he wasn't even particularly esteemed among the utopianists, an irony which rankled the dystopianist. It was as though the Dire One didn't mind seeing his work buried in the insipid utopian magazines. He didn't seem to crave recognition of any kind, let alone the hard-won oppositional stance the dystopianist treasured. It was almost as though the Dire One's stories, posted in public, were really private messages of reproach from one man to the other. Sometimes the dystopianist wondered if he were in fact the only reader the Dire Utopianist had, and the only one he wanted. The cabbages were hopeless, the dystopianist saw now. Gazing out the window over his coffee's last plume of steam at the humming, pencil-colored school buses, he suddenly understood the gross implausibility. A rapidly inflating cabbage could never have the stopping power to alter the fatal trajectory of a careening steel egg carton full of young lives. A cabbage might halt a Hyundai, maybe a Volvo, never a school bus. Anyway, the cabbages as an image had no implications, no reach. They said nothing about mankind. They were, finally, completely stupid and lame. He gulped the last of his coffee angrily. He had to go deeper, find something resonant, something to crawl beneath the skin of reality and render it monstrous from within. He paced to the sink, began rinsing his coffee mug. A tiny pod of silt had settled at the bottom, and now, under a jet of cold tap water, the grains rose and spread and danced, a model of chaos. The dystopianist retraced his seed of inspiration. Well-intentioned, bumbling geneticist, good. Good enough. The geneticist needed to stumble onto something better, though. One day, when the dystopianist and the dire utopianist had been in the sixth grade at Intermediate School 293, cowering together in a corner of the schoolyard to duck sports and fights and girls in one deft, multi-purpose cower, they had arrived at a safe island of mutual interest, comic books, Marvel brand, which anyone who read them understood weren't comic at all, but deadly, breathtakingly serious. Marvel constructed worlds of splendid complexity, full of chilling ancient villains and tormented heroes in richly unfinished storylines. There in the schoolyard, wedged for cover behind the girls' lunch hour game of hopscotch, the dystopianist declared his favorite character, Dr. Doom, antagonist of the Fantastic Four. Dr. Doom wore a forest green cloak and hood over a metallic slitted mask and armor. He was a dark king who from his gnarled castle ruled a city of hapless serfs, an imperial, self-righteous monster. The dire utopianist murmured his consent. Indeed, Dr. Doom was awesome, an honorable choice. The dystopianist waited for the dire utopianist to declare his favorite. Black Bolt, said the dire utopianist. The dystopianist was confused. Black Bolt wasn't a villain or a hero. Black Bolt was part of an outcast band of mutant characters known as the Inhumans, the noblest among them. He was their leader, but he never spoke. His only demonstrated power was flight, but the whole point of Black Bolt was the power he restrained himself from using, speech. The sound of his voice was cataclysmic, an unusable weapon like an atomic bomb. If Black Bolt ever uttered a syllable, the world would crack in two. Black Bolt was leader in absentia much of the time. He had a tendency to exile himself from the scene, to wander distant mountaintops contemplating, what? His curse? The things he would say if he could safely speak? It was an unsettling choice there, amidst the feral shrieks of the schoolyard. The dystopianist changed the subject and never raised the question of Marvel Comics with the dire utopianist again. Alone behind the locked door of his bedroom, the dystopianist studied Black Bolt's behavior, seeking hints of the character's appeal to his schoolmate. Perhaps the answer lay in a storyline elsewhere in the Marvel universe, one where Black Bolt shucked off his pensiveness to function as an unrestrained hero or villain. If so, the dystopianist never found the comic book in question. Suicide, the dystopianist concluded now. The geneticist should be studying suicide, seeking to isolate it as a factor in the human genome. The Sylvia Plath Code, that might be the title of the story. The geneticist could be trying to reproduce it in a non-human species. Right. Good. To breed for suicide in animals, to produce a creature with the impulse to take its own life, that had the relevance the dystopianist was looking for. What animals? Something poignant and pathetic, something pure. Sheep. The Sylvia Plath sheep, that was it. A variant of sheep had been bred for the study of suicide. The Sylvia Plath sheep had to be kept on close watch, like a prisoner stripped of sharp implements, shoelaces, and belt. And the Plath sheep escapes, right, of course. A Frankenstein creature always escapes. But the twist is that the Plath sheep is dangerous only to itself. So what? What harm if a single sheep quietly, discreetly offs itself? But the Plath sheep, scribbling fingers racing now, the dystopianist was on fire. The Plath sheep turns out to have the gift of communicating its despair. Like the monkeys on that island who learned from one another to wash clams, or break them open with coconuts, whatever it was the monkeys had learned. Look into it later. the Plath sheep evoked suicide in other creatures, all up and down the food chain. Not humans, but anything else that crossed its path. Cats, dogs, cows, beetles, clams. Each creature would spread suicide to another, to five or six others, before searching out a promontory from which to plunge to its death. The human species would be powerless to reverse the craze, the epidemic of suicide among the non-human species of the planet. Okay, right! Let goddamn Black Bolt open his mouth and sing an aria! He couldn't halt the Plath sheep in its deadly spiral of despair! The dystopianist suddenly had a vision of the Plath sheep wandering its way into the background of one of the Dire One's tales. It would go unremarked at first, a bucolic detail, unwrapping its bleak gift of global animal suicide, only after it had been taken entirely for granted, just as the Dire One's own little nuggets of despair were smuggled innocuously into his utopias. The Plath sheep was a bullet of pure dystopian intention. The dystopianist wanted to fire it in the dire utopianist's direction. Maybe he'd send this story to encouraging. Even better, he'd like it if he could send the Plath sheep itself to the door of the Dire One's writing room. Here's your tragic mute Black Bolt, you bastard! Touch its somber muzzle, dry its moist obsidian eyes, runny with sleep goo. Try to talk it down from the parapet if you have the courage of your ostensibly rosy convictions. Explain to the Sylvia Plath sheep why life is worth living. Or, failing that, let the sheep convince you to follow it up to the brink and go. You and the sheep, pal. Take a fall. There was a knock on the door. The dystopianist went to the door and opened it. Standing in the corridor was a sheep. The dystopianist checked his watch. 9:45. He wasn't sure why it mattered to him what time it was, but it did. He found it reassuring. The day still stretched before him. He'd have plenty of time to resume work after this interruption. He still heard the children's voices leaking in through the front window from the street below. The children arriving now were late for school. There were always hundreds who were late. He wondered if the sheep had waited with the children for the crossing guard to wave it on. He wondered if the sheep had crossed at the green or recklessly dared the traffic to kill it. He'd persuaded himself that the sheep was voiceless, so it was a shock when it spoke. "May I come in?" said the sheep. "Yeah, sure," said the dystopianist, fumbling his words. Should he offer the sheep the couch or a drink of something? The sheep stepped into the apartment just far enough to allow the door to be closed behind it, then stood quietly, working its nifty little jaw back and forth and blinking. Its eyes were not watery at all. "So," said the sheep, nodding its head at the dystopianist's desk, the mass of yellow legal pads, the sharpened pencils bunched in their holder, the typewriter. "This is where the magic happens." The sheep's tone was wearily sarcastic. "It isn't usually magic," said the dystopianist, then immediately regretted the remark. "Oh, I wouldn't say that," said the sheep, apparently unruffled. "You've got a few things to answer for." "Is that what this is?" said the dystopianist. "Some kind of reckoning?" "Reckoning?" The sheep blinked as though confused. "Who said anything about a reckoning?" "Never mind," said the dystopianist. He didn't want to put words into the sheep's mouth. Not now. He'd let it represent itself and try to be patient. But the sheep didn't speak, only moved in tiny, faltering steps on the carpet, advancing very slightly into the room. The dystopianist wondered if the sheep might be scouting for sharp corners on the furniture, for chances to do itself harm by butting with great force against his fixtures. "Are you very depressed?" asked the dystopianist. The sheep considered the question for a moment. "I've had better days, let's put it that way." Finishing the thought, it stared up at him, eyes still dry. The dystopianist met its gaze, then broke away. A terrible thought occurred to him. The sheep might be expecting him to relieve it of its life. The silence was ponderous. The dystopianist considered another possibility. Might his rival have come to him in disguised form? He cleared his throat before speaking. "You're not, the Dire One, by any chance?" The dystopianist was going to be awfully embarrassed if the sheep didn't know what he was talking about. The sheep made a solemn, wheezing sound, like, then it said, "I'm Dire, all right. But I'm hardly the only one." "Who?" blurted the dystopianist. Take a look in the mirror, friend.
What's your point?
The dystopianist was sore now. If the sheep thought he was going to be manipulated into suicide, it had another think coming. Just this. How many sheep have to die to assuage your childish resentments? Now the sheep assumed an odd, false tone, bluff like that of a commercial pitchman. They laughed when I sat down at the dystopiano, but when I began to play... Very funny. We try, we try. Look, could you at least offer me a dish of water or something? I had to take the stairs. Couldn't reach the button for the elevator. Silenced, the dystopianist hurried into the kitchen and filled a shallow bowl with water from the tap. Then, thinking twice, he poured it back into the sink and replaced it with mineral water from the bottle in the door of his refrigerator. When he set it out, the sheep lapped gratefully, steadily, seeming to the dystopianist an animal at last.
Okay. It licked its lips. That's it, Dr. Doom. I'm out of here. Sorry for the intrusion. Next time I'll call. I just wanted, you know, a look at you.
The dystopianist couldn't keep from saying, You don't want to die?
Not today, was the sheep's simple reply.
The dystopianist stepped carefully around the sheep to open the door, and the sheep trotted out. The dystopianist trailed it into the corridor and summoned the elevator. When the cab arrived and the door opened, the dystopianist leaned in and punched the button for the lobby.
Thanks, said the sheep. It's the little things that count.
The dystopianist tried to think of a proper farewell, but couldn't before the elevator door shut. The sheep was facing the rear of the elevator cab, another instance of its poor grasp of etiquette. Still, the sheep's visit wasn't the worst the dystopianist could imagine. It could have attacked him or tried to gore itself on his kitchen knives. The dystopianist was still proud of the Plath sheep and rather glad to have met it, even if the Plath sheep wasn't proud of him. Besides, the entire episode had only cost the dystopianist an hour or so of his time. He was back at work, eagerly scribbling out implications, extrapolations, another illustrious downfall, well before the yelping children reoccupied the schoolyard at lunchtime.